Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to Hawkbinge, your map of the post-apocalyptic wasteland that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of a longtime fan, which would be me, and a first-time listener in New York, which would be Matt. How's life in New York, Matt?
Well, I survived, Andy. I don't know if you saw the news recently, just to date the podcast again, but we had one heck of a storm. New York got off lightly compared to some of the states, but we had a good 2 days of near constant rain, which was very like Jurassic Park vibes. But fortunately, that seems to have gone.
Wow.
The storm has actually brought with it a feeling of relief on the other side of it. So maybe it is the end of summer.
Yeah. Speaking of post-apocalyptic wastelands, you've had a bit of it. I mean, I wake up every day and look outside and all I see is water, but that's because I live next to a river. It's a bit different for you, isn't it?
It would actually be weirder for you if you woke up and there wasn't water.
Indeed, it would be. Well, we're ready to go. This is going to be cool. Before we start, we are honored members of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. And if you are interested in band stories and album histories and things, particularly with regard to any of these bands, Black Sabbath, Uriah Heep, Deep Purple, Iron Maiden, and obviously they've just released a new album, so that's worth checking out, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Queen, or if you just like the kind of stories that T-Bone Mathley tells on his podcast, he's had a life in music, then this is something you should definitely check out. There are two brand new members of the network, the Diary of a Mad Men podcast with Ozzy Osbourne, and universally speaking, the Red Hot Chili Peppers podcast. So there's a huge amount to properly deep dive into. 8 bands there who'd be interesting to see who would win that little clash and fight it out to be the support band on the festival lineup, with Hawkwind obviously headlining. You can Google Deep Dive Podnet at Deep Dive Podnet and find all of those shows, which I suggest that you do. So Matt and I have been endlessly playing Quark, Strangeness and Charm over recent weeks, and you all know Matt's deep process for listening to albums, how much he gets into that. But man cannot live on Hawkwind alone, though many have tried. What else have you been listening to, Matt, in these past few weeks?
Well, Andy, I was looking at music around this kind of time to see if there was anything I had, just to kind of try and keep that late 1970s vibe alive. And one of the tracks which I realized I had on 7-inch, which is one of my favorite tracks of all time, is actually from this year, 1977. The artist is the Jan Hammer Group. I heard this track, which is called Don't You Know, played in a club in Berlin. It was the Suicide Circus, which is techno, tech house, that kind of stuff. It was 5 in the morning. And the last track this guy played was this track. And it's almost proto house in the way it's arranged, a little bit like some of the things that we've talked about that Hawkwind have done. Really beautiful soft keys and Mr. Hammer himself floating these really nice vocals over the top of it. But it is one of those tracks where I'm surprised that the date and the quality of the synthesizer marry up how they do. This track has this infectious, Moog, heavily filtered refrain through the entire thing. It's the first thing you hear. Everything else layers over it. And then when everything else disappears, it's still there. And you kind of realize, oh, it's been there the whole time. And I hadn't realized. And for me, that's still very much an 80s thing. But this is carrying on my education that, no, this was something that was happening a lot sooner than I thought. So yeah, continuing my 70s synth band based appreciation binge, the Jan Hammer Group is my first track. The album is called Melodies. The track is called Don't You Know. The whole album is great, but this track is an absolute standout killer for me.
Fair. Well, stop. It's hammer time. Anything else?
To kind of follow on from last podcast's slightly, somber feelings when we were thinking about music, we lost Lee Scratch Perry last week. He had lived to a ripe old age and was one of the founding characters of reggae and dub and that kind of vibe to a larger audience. I don't have a huge amount of Lee Perry tracks, but he was always a character for me of some influence because, again, growing up, you know, after you finish listening to your parents' records and you start to sonically break out on your own and try to figure out what it is that you really like and what is contemporary and interesting to you. I actually remember the first time I really found something where I was like, oh, this is new and exciting and I want to know more about it. I walked into a record shop in Oxford. I had £10 in my pocket. I had a £10 note and I was going to blow it on a thing. And I just grabbed a tape pack. I didn't even really know what it was, but it looked cool. This is back in the day when club nights and event festivals, when they did a live gig, they would record it. And then for anyone who missed the gig, they would just put it all on cassette. So I grabbed that. And the first cassette was an hour-long mix by DJ Die doing very percussive drum and bass. And it was the first time I'd ever heard anything like it. You know, the speed, the energy, all of that completely blew me away. And I started to do a lot of research on that and learning how drum and bass was only really possible because of like the Jamaican influence coming into the UK and how the music they brought mixed with like the youthful music of the UK. There's a lot of that stuff, which I still really, really like. So to hear of Lee Scratch Perry's passing was a kind of a foundational loss for me. Like I said, I don't have a huge amount of his own work, but as a tribute to him, I am going to put a track called Iron Gate into the Sessions playlist, which he produced along with King Tubby, who again is a really big progenitor of that kind of music. That's the one which I do reach for if ever I want to just put some good dub on. So yeah, Iron Gate is a tribute to Scratch Perry and rest in power to him.
Indeed, and a worthy tribute, and really happy to have something on the Sessions playlist for that purpose. All of our time comes and people pass on. It's interesting that when these influential people do meet their time, one thing that does happen is it reconnects us to the incredible influence and power of what they did, which otherwise might have just become part of our background. So it's brilliant to reconnect with some of that and experience it again. So an excellent pick.
It does become that strange kind of blip, doesn't it? Yeah, you have the blip of discovery and then the blip of loss, and they each produce a different kind of energy. I always sometimes think it's a little crass societarily when like someone dies and then suddenly their album sales go up.
Yeah.
It's not like you weren't thinking of them before. It's just that now, obviously, there is a new emotional weight to it. So I think that I've definitely revised my position on that.
Yeah. No, well played. Well played indeed.
Thank you. All right, Andy, now it's your turn to spill some beans because last podcast you teased me, which has now been over a month, I think, since you told me that you'd found a cool new band and refused to tell me.
Indeed, I went on at length about a new band I discovered and then didn't choose that band as my turntable pick. So it's a really interesting one. I don't really know how this turned up in my Google feed because there was no reference to anything else I liked in the article that came up with them. I also don't know how it's possible that I hadn't discovered them before because they've got about 8 albums or something. So this may be one where I say the name of this band, everybody goes, you didn't know them? So Matt, have you ever heard of Mythic Sunship?
I don't think so.
Oh, thank God for that. So they are from Denmark and they sit firmly in that sphere that we talked about last time where Yuri Gagarin sit, where Samsara Blues Experiment sit. And they've been around for 10 years or so. They had some albums that were very much in the kind of Yuri Gagarin-esque style, and they are Scandinavian, they're from Denmark, including albums like Upheaval, which have a real cosmicness to them and also a doominess to them. But around a couple of albums ago, they picked up a saxophone player and just added them into the band, which I think is an interesting thing that Hawkwind tend to do and just incorporate new things. And then the music takes on a fusion-y kind of a vibe. And around the cosmicness also there is this kind of fusion thing going on. And it's really interesting what they've done. I like kind of both aspects of the band. They've got some really interesting music out there with the artwork. From a graphic design point of view, you'd love it. Some of the different album covers they've come up with. They have a new album called Wildfire, which is out this year on TP Records. The track that I've selected is Maelstrom. I could really have selected any of the tracks from the album. It's not one where there's kind of one that leaps out. The whole thing just kind of really works. As they go from this quite jazzy kind of a feel to a more cosmic kind of a feel and move around within that, they're really interesting. I've never seen them on the bill of anything that we've gone to because I think the name, when I saw the story, it was the name Mythic Sunship that just said to me, oh, I'm probably going to like this. You know, they're not going to have to work that hard to bring me into this, I suspect. It's only if this turns out to be an absolute racket that I'm not going to like it. And it wasn't, basically. So they're a really interesting band to check out. And it would be interesting to see if they do tour. I've not seen them, as I say, on any of the lineups that we've been to. And so a bit of a discovery, despite the fact that they've got a bunch of albums out there.
That is always a strange thing, isn't it? When you discover something and realize that they've been around for a very long time. But again, in the age that we are in, there's so much information to wade through that that's actually sometimes a really nice discovery when you like something and you realize there's more of it. Because there's something kind of annoying when someone releases a great album that you like and then you go and look for more and that's their first album. I mean, that's kind of cool because you're at the beginning, but you're also like, damn, I wanted more of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in this day and age when it takes people another 5 years to record the second album.
Very true.
So my second pick here is, it takes me back a few years ago when we were both working in the London office and there were lots of kind of genres that we were finding, subgenres of genres, and it goes pretty deep. And we were finding things like waltzcore and finding all of this very, very funny and then coming up with new genres of our own and laughing. And one of them that we came up with was doom jazz that we thought was extremely funny. Basically, and then Googled it and found out that doom jazz is actually a thing. There were at least two or three bands actually actively playing doom jazz. One of them was a band called Bowron and the Club of Gore, who I checked out. And we kind of found out that doom jazz is basically fairly traditional jazz in instrumentation, but incredibly slow. The kind of thing you could imagine hearing at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning in a basement Parisian jazz club with a whiskey and everyone feeling really sad and morose. But these bands adopt the trappings of doom with like skulls and, you know, church bells and rain and all this kind of thing. So it's fascinating stuff. The other band that was in this mold was a band who I subsequently bought a lot of albums by, which is the fantastically named Mount Fuji Doom Jazz Corporation. They would improvise and play live. I bought a few of their albums. They had a bit more of an electronic vibe. And I subsequently found that they were the live improv offshoot of another fantastically named band called the Kilimanjaro Dark Jazz Ensemble. So whoever is in these bands has a penchant for fantastic names for bands. And I couldn't find their stuff on vinyl until very recently, where a couple of them have been re-released on the Ad Noisium and Denavali labels. So I've managed to get hold of their second and third albums. The one that I really love out of this is Here Be Dragons. I was really interested to see what the studio manifestation of this band would be. And it does have a lot in common with this kind of thing that we talked about, the kind of traditional jazzy thing, but really, really slow. But there are other elements in here. There's quite a lot of a trip-hop vibe going on. It's almost like it's more Portishead than Portishead. And there is a female vocalist, and it has that trippy vibe to it and instrumentation. And there's some electronics thrown in with the different instrumentation. And it's really haunting. It's a beautiful album. As I say, it's out there on vinyl. You can get it. The track that I've chosen is Lead Squid or Lead Squid, depending on which way you read it. And it's really worthwhile checking out. And from something that we both found hilariously funny, basically, it's now something that I love quite a lot and have a good few albums of.
Lead Squid would be the partner to Iron Monkey that we created last podcast.
Yes, yes, indeed. That's another great festival lineup coming our way. Tracks from those albums will find their way onto the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist volume 3 that we are starting now to put together, having officially put volume 2 out there last time and kind of promoted the existence of those playlists. And, you know, fantastically for us, we've got a bit of response to those. I've got a few followers and a Rupert Dandy on Twitter found the Volume 2 playlist and got in touch through Twitter to point out that he might have been about to read the Charles Stross book, Saturn's Children, which is a Hawkwind-esque novel at this point, if ever there was one, and used the playlist as the backing for him reading that book, which I think would be amazing. And I hope he did it. And please let us know if you did. So it's great for us on those playlists to put some of our music alongside the Hawkwind music. This is the environment that we listen to these albums in. And it's great for us to put those things out there. And even better for us that some other people have connected to it and seem to be enjoying it. On that feedback note, we've had a few comments and conversations. One really interesting conversation that I got into on Twitter involved both Ian Abrahams and Joe Banks, the authors of the books that we refer to, Sonic Assassins and Days of the Underground, respectively. where Joe had commented on the rather amazing diversity in Hawkwind output, in style and instrumentation and tone and everything else over the years. And I'd suggested that a lot of that was to do with the fact that as Hawkwind take on new people into the band, you know, they absorb and those people get to do what they want to do. So if you played the xylophone and you got on with Hawkwind, you'd end up in the band and you would write xylophone music and the band would play it and you would do xylophone solos instead of the guitar solo that was there before. And that's part of this rather organic development of the band's sound. Ian Abrahams then pointed out that actually a lot of people then miss the point really with Hawkwind, where there is this almost Spinal Tap turnover in people in the band. And people kind of coming and going for various reasons. But it's actually the constant change that defines the change in sound. Basically, that was really interesting and great to have those two in the same conversation. Maybe that's something we'll be able to engineer again. We got some good feedback on the Astounding Sounds episode. Philip Gwynne-Jones, Haligo and Phil, he said he was on a long, long journey today, but it's been made easier by Andy, Matt and Hawkbinge as they investigate 76's Astounding Sound, Amazing Music, the ultimate Marmite Hawkwind album, and one that I think is sorely underrated. Well, that must have been a long, long journey, because that was a long, long episode. And Baps Af, which is a Cipriana on Twitter, said it was an interesting episode. I do struggle with this album, as I feel it's a little underpowered, though I do like the instrumental stuff. Steppenwolf is good, but I think a lot better. And we got a lot of different reactions to the album, but a lot of good reactions to the podcast, which is great. A couple of notes that were really nice. Jones the Boat said that he is thoroughly enjoying these podcasts. Matt's take on each album and the progression of the music is consistently fascinating. So well done, Matt. Round of applause. And he's really looking forward to the views on Quark. So not long to wait now, Jones the Boat. And Mr. Snodes points out these albums were all well established when I first heard them in the mid-80s. So it's really interesting to slow down and hear them step by step, which is the journey that we're on. So it's great for you to join us on that journey. And, you know, we love those stories.
And props to using the word interesting. I appreciated that.
Exactly. We didn't know where that was going to conclude until you got there. There is a review that I spotted, which is either on the 6th of July or the 7th of June, depending on which way round this date is, from Scott Listener on Apple Podcasts, who said, I have never heard of Hawkwind before. I had no idea they were even a thing until I found out about this podcast. And now I'm excited to dig into their music because our hosts have such a passion for their music. Well done. That kind of review kind of means everything to us. People who are through the podcast, either reconnecting with music that they once loved or haven't heard in a long time, or even better, discovering this music for the first time. That's an amazing reward for us doing this podcast. And it leads to me making a bit of a request here, because apparently, we're told that reviews and the ratings, that five-star rating, actually has quite a lot of impact in the surfacing of shows to people who are discovering podcasts and all these different players. As I understand it, Apple is the platform where these happen. I haven't seen ratings on too many others, but the Apple ones, I think, are the ones that carry the most weight. So if you are enjoying the ride and you do have a minute to spare, we would appreciate a five-star review and a little word here or there. If it helps connect people to the podcast and then to this music that we're all so passionate about, then that would be a job well done. It's not a commercial enterprise for us. We don't make any money. In fact, podcasting has its costs. So this is a money-losing operation. Any help that you can provide to us to get a bigger audience and connect more people would be massively appreciated. Lastly, in the postbag section, I asked the question of the Astounding Sounds album, where there were two artists, Tony Hyde and Barney Bubbles, and each did one side of the cover. Who did which? And it turns out that Barney Bubbles did the big kind of rather fascistic hawk image that's on the what is now the back cover. And Elric Newby, who is the author of the book that we refer to as kind of the litmus test of where these albums stand in Hawkwind fandom, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums, both he and Joe Banks pointed out that fact to us. So thank you very much for that.
That feels way more Bubble-esque, that one, even though I still think it was completely inappropriate. If I was going to have to put money on who did what, I think the Bubbles one makes sense to have been that.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also the image which has become the really iconic one. It's the one that is the image that featured on the tour programs. It's the image that featured in the posters. So strangely, it is the back cover of that album, which ended up being the iconic image for the album. So yeah, an interesting one there, and definitely very bubbly. Now it is time for us to journey into 1977, which is the kind of explosive year that I had been surprised to find that 1976 was not. So we are now in the era of punk. Those bands who formed in 76 are now releasing music, and it is having an impact. Now, we've touched on Hawkwind and punk and the influence it had before. So some of these references we've done on previous shows, but this is really where those references live. So before we get into the albums that are released this year, just a bit of a refresher on how influential Hawkwind were on the people who are releasing those albums. In particular, John Lydon, aka Johnny Rotten, in a noisy article on Hawkwind and punk, points out that Johnny Rotten was a huge fan, used to attend early Hawkwind gigs regularly, stating in interviews that there would be no Sex Pistols if it wasn't for Brainstorm. And in another article, it's pointed out that John Lydon was a regular presence at their gigs and was kind of taken under Bob Calvert's wing at the height of Sex Pistols mania. And he attended Bob Calvert's wedding reception, which is a strange image, but a fantastic one. And that Joe Strummer and Mick Jones grew up in kind of Hawkwind's world, and Brian James and Captain Sensible of the Damned were huge fans. And Stephen Morris, the drummer of Joy Division and then New Order, said in an article about his top 13 albums, he said that there's an idea of punk being a zero-hour movement, but the Stooges had been going for ages, and they were punk. The MC5 were punk, and Hawkwind. I think punk rock started because in every small town, there was someone who liked Hawkwind. So this is really powerful stuff. There's even another article on a punk website, Punk77, where the person who writes for that website is clearly enamored of Hawkwind. And he says that Hawkwind stayed different and perhaps uniquely in popular music. They stayed true to their ideals and still do. Punk didn't affect them at all, he says. It re-energized them. Listen to Death Trap on PXR5 for an all-out punk sonic attack. He also points out that Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks and Magazine were influenced by Space Ritual. And he says, in an era of stadium rock, they went out and played for free to people at any place that would have them. They never conformed. So Hawkwind really is a driver of this punk age. And there are lots of things that happen this year in the world of punk. The Sex Pistols attempted to interrupt the Silver Jubilee celebrations. This is 1977, by performing their version of God Save the Queen from a boat on the Thames. The Clash headlined the opening night of London's only punk rock club, the Roxy. The Sex Pistols had their contract terminated by EMI in response to their disruptive behaviour. This is before they'd actually released their first album. At the same time, Kiss were elected the most popular band in America by a Gallup poll. So clearly there's some post-apocalyptic stuff going on in the States at that point. The tragic plane crash carrying a number of members of Lynyrd Skynyrd crashes, killing members Ronnie Van Zant, guitarist Steve Gaines. Tragic things there. On August the 20th, NASA's unmanned probe Voyager 2 is launched, carrying a golden record containing sounds and images representing life on Earth. Surely that just should have been In Search of Space. It's the only thing that would make sense. So when we get to the albums that are released this year, and as I said before, these were things I was kind of expecting to see the beginnings of last year in 76. What we see now is the avalanche happens. So there are two albums from the Ramones, Leave Home and Rocket to Russia. The Buzzcocks release Spiral Scratch, The Runaways, Queens of Noise, Damn, Damn, Damned by The Damned, The Clash come out with their eponymous record. Two albums from The Jam, In the City, This is the Modern World. Motorhead released their first album, and I would suggest that whether Motorhead are or are not a punk band is irrelevant. Their music very much lives within this kind of milieu. Talking Heads come out with an album this year, Talking Heads 77. Ian Dury, New Boots and Panties. And Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, really, you know, the flag bearer for all this kind of thing. all come out in 1977. At the same time, some respected artists are changing their sound. Bowie comes out with both Low and Heroes, firmly in his Berlin school here. And Brian Eno releases Before and After Science. At the same time, there are a lot of bands still releasing the things that they would be famous for. Rumours comes out from Fleetwood Mac, obviously an absolute landmark and still a kind of revered album. Animals comes out by Pink Floyd, which actually has quite a punk ethic to it if you look at those lyrics. Yes, release Going for the One. There is Bad Reputation from Thin Lizzy. Foreigner release their eponymous album. There is Love Gun by Kiss that we've already spoken about here. News of the World from Queen. Innocent Victim from Uriah Heep. Street Survivors by Lynyrd Skynyrd. So some for the Deep Dive Network right there. So there's a huge amount going on. There is even an album from Donny Osmond. God bless him. And the Bay City Rollers, if you remember them, they release It's a Game. They are still going at this point. So huge amounts of things going on, a real kind of melting pot of different music happening at this point. But the punk explosion is here. So Hawkwind enter the studio in February 77 to record this album in amongst all of this stuff going on. They would see all this music happening. And the lineup that records this album is a stripped down one from what we've seen before. We've obviously seen Powell and Rudolph and founder member Nick Turner have departed at this point. We are left with Dave Brock and Robert Calvert, who pretty much kind of won that, you know, sliding doors moment battle that we saw last time out. Simon House and Simon King are still in the band as keyboardist, violin player, drummer, respectively. And Adrian Shaw comes into the band as the bass player and I think has quite a big impact on the making of this album. It's released in June 77. It makes number 30 on the charts. So it doesn't do as well as some of those earlier albums, like Warrior, like Space Ritual. But still, it's pretty solid at number 30. And I think if you're changing your lineup and your sound as much as Hawkwind do, then bringing enough of your audience with you to hit 30 is not too bad. They actually got some fairly decent reviews here. But it's interesting also that these reviews are definitely through gritted teeth. It feels like here is a press which is giving Hawkwind some chops here, but doesn't really want to. The sounds note that the band are still capable of making a stir. Melody Maker says they have gone part of the way in rehabilitating themselves, but also note that the lyrical improvement is not matched instrumentally nor structurally. NME assessed it as sci-fi comic book thrills to the proles, which is about as condescending a statement as I've ever seen in music press, which both puts down the band and everyone who likes them. Only this time around, Bob Calvert's psychotic sense of humour is well to the fore, which is well said. This is my favourite, though. NME states that musically, it's all battering ram riffs and monoplane synthesised drones, with Dave Brock occasionally cutting loose on guitar. Now, that's quite clearly intended to be quite snide. But Matt, if I actually rang you up and said, Matt, there's a band playing tonight and they're all battering ram riffs and monoplane synthesized drones and occasional cutting loose on guitar, you're leaving the house at pace to join me to see that band, right? It reminds me of our mutual friend Duane and I at Desert Fest, and the last venue still going was the Black Heart, which we've mentioned before. So we charged down there without knowing who was on, and you have to get up the stairs to get into the venue itself. And as we're going up the stairs, a guy is coming down the stairs, and we said, "Who's on?" And he went, "I don't know." And we went, "What is it?" And he went, "Oh, it's awful. They only play one note." And we looked at each other and just sprinted up the stairs to see this band, which turned out to be Bong, which is hilarious. They made their first mainstream UK appearance to support this, performing on Mark Boland's Tea Time Pop Show, where Mark Boland suggested that they were the band who should have written Star Wars but didn't, which is quite funny. Robert Calvert wore an aviator's helmet and carried a stuffed falcon on one hand, which on a Tea Time Pop Show would have been quite something for the kids to behold, I suspect. Live, it was pointed out to me recently that Hawkwind on stage were doing some interesting things. So Calvert cuts up a big American flag with this saber that he carries around. And they had a 10-foot burning cross on stage. I'd suggest that you'd be kind of lucky to see out the year alive if you did those things today. So very much of their time. So that is where the band are at and what the music world is giving us in 1977. It is now time to find out, for the benefit of particularly of Jones the Boat, who has been waiting for this moment, what is Matt's hot take of Quark, Strangeness and Charm?
Something that I've noticed as we've gone further in time, I guess, throughout the Hawkwind discography, we've gone from a time which I really didn't know much about, like the, you know, the early 70s. I have these kind of blurry ideas of Woodstocks and flared jeans and like Pieces and Loves and that kind of thing. But as you get close to the end of the 70s, I feel like culturally I'm much more aware of what's going on. You know, I've seen enough punk documentaries to understand what's going on. In the world, the Cold War is still like a thing. There's a lot of British civic upheaval around this kind of time. So I feel like I am coming online culturally. So it's getting harder to judge the band just as the album, you know? And I feel like that's probably true of most bands. So I don't think it's wrong to do that, but I'm just more aware of it. Like this year especially is an interesting time, because I think when you just talked about the Voyager 2, like space is becoming less of a dream and is now becoming a reality. People are going out into space. People are sending things into space. The idea of satellites are not a distant dream. They're around all the time. So it's interesting how sci-fi still exists, but it's interestingly coming into a kind of level with reality where we're now figuring out that we can't warp drive to Jupiter and shake hands with an alien. We are going to send something which is essentially made of tinfoil out into the universe with a record on it. You know, they're two very different things. So there's an interesting kind of mix of like reality and not. And I think that does shape bands a little bit, because as well as having fantasies about the future and possibilities, they are obviously like living in the now. And I think that that's possibly reflected a little bit in this album. This album comes a lot back to sci-fi. There is still variety in this album, but there's much more of a theme, not a topic, a theme. You know, like Warrior on the Edge of Time had a topic, which was the book. And, you know, like everything kind of went through that lens, which made it very focused, but then meant that you either kind of liked it or you didn't. This just has much more of just a sci-fi theme and is covering lots of different types of sci-fi events and stories, which I think is cool. And I think is much better for someone to listen to, because it just allows the whole thing to have a lot more breadth to it. And it does mean that if you don't like the topic, then you're less likely to like the album. But now it feels like there's something that everyone could grab hold of. But definitely, I think you can feel that this is Calvert's album and Brock's album. It is much more vocal led, and there are a lot more stories in it, for better or worse, I guess. But it's very obvious that people who won solidified their position in the band very quickly. So it's more like the previous album than I thought it was going to be, in a way, musically. There are some of the still long breakdowns. There are a few instrumentally things, but there's definitely a lot more story and vocal and that kind of thing in the album. I think that there's a bit more realistic dystopia in a way. Like, you know, we've gone back to atom bombs a bit. Even though the galactic civilization's falling down, you could attribute that to humanity in the same kind of way. So there's some more like maybe like allegorical kind of pieces to it. I know that you just said I hadn't heard that review before where they said the psychotic sense of humor. Sometimes I'm with it and sometimes I find it massively off-putting. The idea of like Calvert wandering onto a TV show with a fake hawk on his hand, I'm like, yes, of course he did. I think there's very few things you could say he did that I would be surprised at. And I think that just the band has a little bit less of a filter than maybe I would like it to. And I think sometimes it does it at its own cost. And again, you can either like love Hawkwind for this or be a little bit kind of like cringe about it. And I think just I vacillate between the two, I guess. Like the idea of cutting up an American flag on stage, even if it's just ironically or theatrically or whatever, I find a little bit cringe. I don't really know why they've done that. But that also comes down to the fascistic hawk emblem. Like, you don't have to do that, but they do. And I know that, like, early punk, you used to get sometimes people would, like, put swastikas on their t-shirts and stuff to, like, deliberately, like, provoke. And I guess, like, you know, looking at it from 2021, there are some of those things which just feel more problematic, because I guess we've kind of, like, you know, swung back the other way. It was more naive then, I guess. You know, like, you walked around a swastika now, you'd be in way more trouble than if you were just 18 and everyone rolls their eyes and goes, well, if that's what you're going to do. But, you know, it's almost like we've swung to the point where now people can just shout anyone's a Nazi on news and we all just kind of like move on with our lives. So, you know, it's a strange time to be looking at this kind of stuff and not find it problematic. But it's a difficult one to vocalize. And so I'm going to say it, and it'd be interesting to know if you understand even what I'm saying. But a Johnny Rotten kind of guy with a swastika on his t-shirt, a denim jacket with spikes all over it, hair in a mohawk, and like big Doc Martin boots stomping around is somehow less weird than someone going on TV with a stuffed hawk on their hand. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does, because I don't think, and we haven't discussed this before, so we're both kind of riffing this, but Hawkwind very rarely, they do at one point on this album, but they're very rarely as obvious and on the nose. There's a lot of you actually having to listen and take things in before you see where the view is. The kind of these big statements like, you know, cutting up an American flag, which I think I know what that's in reference to, is a song that we'll get to. It's a consumerist thing, I think. Could be wrong. But there's not an awful lot of that. It's more of a message that comes through in kind of the ambience of what you're listening to. And the occasional song that references things about, you know, urban decay and freedoms and the thought police and things like this. But it's not as in your face, perhaps, as the punk movement was. And Hawkwind obviously are somewhat older than these guys at that point. There's generally a probably a necessary lack of subtlety about putting a brick through a window, which is broadly what that kind of punk generation did, which is not really what Hawkwind do, which I think is kind of what you're getting at.
I think the theatrics of Hawkwind is more polarizing than some that you get in things like punk. I think that's what I'm trying to get to. I think that, you know, I can see why Enemy would roll their eyes at someone dressing like a sea captain to go to a TV show. Whereas, you know, the famous interview with the Sex Pistols when they were like drunk and actually like swore on TV and like that, that was an uproar and stuff. Like Enemy, I'm sure would have loved that, because there's some kind of like, you know, just like zeitgeist feel of that is what is cool, and dressing up like a sea captain isn't. And Hawkwind are so into that, they like go through uncool and then kind of out the other side, so they have this cult following. They're much more cult, and I feel like, you know, publications of the day aren't into cult, because cult is a tricky one, isn't it? Like, you know, cult like goes in and out of acceptance.
Yes.
And I do feel like a lot of people who are seen to be cool and seen to be tastemakers tend to eschew cults, because they don't want to feel like they then get caught up in a kind of cult stank. You know, they don't want to feel like people go, oh, well, I don't like Enemy anymore because they're now, you know, Hawkwind cultists, therefore everything they say is tainted. So they almost have to be a bit snide about it. So reading reviews is obviously difficult. You know, like, you either kind of like liked it and didn't care, or you read it and would ignore them because you were more swayed by what people said than what you were listening to.
Yes, that's true. And I guess the almost through necessity, the mainstream music press being part of the mainstream are not part of the cult. Like, the whole thing of the cult thing is Hawkwind are outsiders. They quite deliberately, and even reference it on this album with the track near the end of the album, are the outsiders and represent the outsiders. And the outside does not include Melody Maker and NME. And Melody Maker and NME are very aware of that and probably don't like it.
No, you can see that they're very much against it on principle, which, again, like, if you like Hawkwind, only boosts the mythos of Hawkwind.
Completely, completely. And in fact, you'd argue that once all of the mainstream press loves your cult band, they're not a cult band anymore.
Right. I also feel like, as well, like, Hawkwind almost don't want more fans. They're doing what they're doing. If you come to them organically, you'll also like them more. You know, I do feel like if you're this kind of band, then this is the right way to go about things. You know, like, I feel like we're big fans of Stuart Lee, and Stuart Lee jokes about this idea that now he's got such a good following that he can't go on Have I Got News For You, because a lot of new people will come in, go, what the hell is this? And actually then might damage the work that he does. I feel like Hawkwind has an almost kind of Stuart Lee, you know, relationship.
Exactly. Stuart Lee says that he can't have his persona of the kind of beaten down, bitter outsider if he's doing sold out shows at the O2. So instead of that, he has to do 28 shows in a row at this small theatre in Leicester Square. Joe Banks talked about this at a really enjoyable evening I went to, where he talked about his book and about the era. Hawkwind sabotaged their own careers at almost every turn. And Dave Brock is on record, as are some of the other band members over the years, of really eschewing rock star status and rock star lifestyle, and kind of quite deliberately staying in the underground. So it's a very interesting place to come from.
But that's punk to me.
Yes.
But again, they did punk in a different way. They did punk by being so weird that it would be almost like toxic to the average pop listener, which is cool. But then punk were different because punk was more aggressively trying to break into something where they weren't supposed to be. Hawkwind were quite happy where they were and be like, no, people will come to us or we'll just be here. Their ability to not care is actually fantastically liberating.
That's exactly right, because punk really, it's been said that punk as a movement kind of lasted about a year. Like, once people were wearing t-shirts held together with safety pins as a fashion look, rather than that's because they couldn't afford a new t-shirt, it was dead at that point. And you get bands like The Clash headlining massive festivals, and it's effectively why they split up, because Joe Strummer, he wanted to remain, you know, like a busker. And, you know, Mick Jones, he was quite happy to go down the rock star route, and it kind of tears bands apart and it changes things dramatically. Hawkwind just never did. I mean, even the Sex Pistols reunited purely to make money and were very overt about that. The tour was called the Filthy Lucre Tour. Like, Hawkwind never, ever actually did that selling out thing, and therefore is actually, as you say, a uniquely sustainable punk ethic.
I don't know if we said this before. Maybe I'll just talk to you about this. I likened Hawkwind once to Rorschach from Watchmen. His idea is always the truth, even if it means bringing down humanity. And, like, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read a 25-year-old comic, you know, he dies at the end because he is the only person willing to expose the truth that has brought peace to the world. And he would rather humanity live in a truth than everyone live in a lie, even if it means world peace. And, you know, and he's killed by Dr. Manhattan for that. And I feel like Hawkwind are kind of like that. You know, they are like, we'll be ourselves, even if it means the destruction of everything. Again, that there's an interesting mix of admiration and danger that comes with that as an attitude. So it is always interesting to see what they produce. And I guess to drag this back to the album, because we've gone off piece to touch, this album isn't as punk as I thought it was going to be. You know, I wasn't expecting suddenly like Hawkwind to start like going crazy with distortion and screaming and stuff, but I thought maybe there'd be a little bit of that. But again, that makes it feel like they're not following what these bands are doing. They're doing their own thing, and it's cool that they have taught some of these new musicians what to do, but they're not letting what is popular right now affect what they want to do, which is be weird and tell their stories.
Yeah, no, very true. And this is probably the deepest and most intriguing hot take that we've ever done. You touched upon earlier on some of the change in theme in the lyrics and the stories they tell. And before we get into it track by track, as Ian Abrahams wrote well on this in Sonic Assassins, where he says that this is the album that crystallized the modern science fiction element of Hawkwind. And compared to the space opera Golden Age SF of Space Ritual, the moment where Urban Gorilla and arguably Psychedelic Warlords aside, the material coalesced around a vision of contemporary scientific advancement juxtaposed with a dystopian rather than utopian outlook. They'd stopped writing elongated declamations of interstellar travel and got themselves back down to Earth, where the lyrics found a new resonance in contemporary concerns such as cloning, nuclear destruction, and a destruction of civilization as represented by the petrol-dollar conflict. The music became sharp, clean, and practically new wave, still bound by electronics and sci-fi effects, tricky but fresh and accessible to an audience beyond the stoners and the stoned of the United Artists era. It's also interesting, he goes on to talk about Robert Calvert, where Calvert sums up talking about modern society in a scientifically advanced age. Calvert summed it up as being, "Not quite the age we are in now, but one we are heading for. I always try to write about things that haven't happened yet, but I'm sure will." And I think there's a lot of that really comes through in the lyrics of the album. And as you pointed out, this is a Hawkwind album where the words are more to the fore and more the reason you listen than anything we've heard before, where Hawkwind lyrics have generally been to create a kind of a cosmic ambience to fit the music. So I think this is going to be an interesting one to get into track by track. So let's do that. And the first track, unmistakably, is Spirit of the Age.
Yeah, this is the first track which, as you quoted, the stories now feel more allegorical, or they are built on things which people are aware of. You know, that, like, going back to things like Adjust Me, sci-fi stuff, which was a bit outside the realms of the idea of, like, could be possible. Where, as you said, things like nuclear power, nuclear bombs, the idea of, like, what hath science wrought is much more popular now. Even, like, you know, like when microwaves started coming into people's houses, the idea of actually we can make new things. Televisions are becoming more ubiquitous. Things have gone from black and white to color. I think at this point you start to get kind of grindhouse 3D movies and, you know, like even like labor-saving devices, washing machines, you know, like the idea of like science making things has really like come up again and is really part of the consciousness. And the idea of like science can make these things which are great, but also science can make these things which are really damn scary is something which people can grasp hold of. So these stories become more relatable and therefore more scary. And the idea of a bomb destroying a city like it did with Hiroshima, you know, we saw that. The fact that that exists is more relatable than the idea of intergalactic time travel, two-dimensional spaceships. So by bringing things down to something more relatable, they are hitting harder in terms of where they'll take your brain. And I really like Hawkwind when they grab a concept and then they play with it and then give you permission to either let it go or go on yourself, you know, and that for me is the definition of inspiration, you know, not something which is so far off that I can't put myself in it, nor so prescriptive that I feel I can't go anywhere. And Hawkwind, I've always feel hits that level, which I really like. And I think Spirit of the Age is an interesting one to start with. It's not going to break my habit of not liking their first track, but this is as close to a first track, which I think I've really liked as they've got. So, you know, that's progress in a way. I think this track has a lot going for it. There's going to be something that I say in a few minutes time, which is then going to be the kind of the wince moment. But the way this opens, like your record is speeding up that whoosh kind of sound, which immediately from nothing to that is a very quick like sonic attack in a way, which just instantly goes, okay, something's happening. It immediately hits the kind of like sinister tone. You know, if you feel like you could hear that going through a panning shot of some sinister sci-fi laboratory where they're experimenting on things, it feels like The Thing or something like that. You then have that overly distorted radio, and, you know, an overly distorted radio immediately evokes things that shouldn't be happening. Either things are out of range, therefore you're just at the edge of safety, or it's you're tuning into something, so there's some clandestine spying thing there, or the idea that you're underground, therefore the waves are breaking up. You know, there's nothing good. No one's doing like a weather report with that much distortion. You know, no one's doing something banal. There's got to be something important going on. So that's cool. I feel like the music that then fades up, which becomes the track, is actually way more happy and kind of just chill after like the evil distorted radio. So that was always a bit of a disconnect for me. But it turns into this floaty track, which plods along for actually quite a while. It's like at least a minute and a half before the actual like lyrics kick in. But then the first line we get out of the whole album is, "I would have liked you to have been deep frozen too." Which, again, if you just stop there and unpack that, there's just like a lot. Something that Hawkwind are really good at doing is creating opening lyrics which immediately put you in a place that you can understand. "I would like you to have been deep frozen too" indicates that the person speaking has been deep frozen. It gives you an idea of then why. So they're probably on a journey, or they're probably like being safe somewhere. The fact that the other person hasn't means that there's immediately a disconnect in both time and place. And then they start to unpack that as well, where they say like, you know, you'll be 60 by now and you'll be dead by the time I return to Earth. So these people are in space. But again, they got froze, which immediately feels more real because we understand now that going through space takes time. I'm not on a two-dimensional ship which can literally go through multi-dimensional places. This was a journey. This feels more real. This is more like 2001, you know, where you're in a big kind of ship that's going to take years rather than I'm there. Then this becomes like a kind of like a letter to two people. Like when it says you, I don't feel like they're saying you like me. It feels more like I'm listening to someone dictate a letter to someone else. And there was a relationship there. And I like the phrase then, but your father refused to sign the forms to freeze you. I like the fact that Hawkwind can get a kind of like feeling of sci-fi being boring, like there's bureaucracy, you know, or like, you know, like, oh no, I had to sign a form, you know, like the idea of space travel and being signed, but then also having to fill in paperwork is again, like this strange dissonance that I feel like only Hawkwind really do. Because again, it adds a sense of realism. But it's funny that that becomes like a lyric because that's not the kind of thing, you know, people don't normally talk about filling in forms. But then the enjoyment of the track is then sideswiped by this annoying lyric where the writer of the letter says, I wish I could remember you how you were still underage. And that is a lyric which is problematic, especially in the age that we're listening to it now. And I know it's kind of like a flippant thing, but it, in its flippancy is almost more annoying. I don't know who wrote this. This wasn't Moorcock, was it?
No, this is Calvert, Robert Calvert.
Fair enough. I mean, it feels like a Moorcock lyric just because he's the one who I feel awkwardly sexualizes Hawkwind in a way which I have never enjoyed. So, you know, for this to be there, it's just kind of like a cringe lyric. And I find it a little bit hard to, it's a bit like that we're tired of making love. It's like, I don't think there was a reason for it to be there. I don't know what it's doing. And it's just, it only serves to annoy me. So that is a problem for me, which means that it's very difficult to like the track because it taints itself.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. You know, we didn't really compare notes on this. I listened to this album months ago, just on a whim, but I really listened to the words in a way I hadn't really done before because, as I said, Hawkwind lyrics generally just serve as a kind of ambient background. And I suddenly picked up on that line. And maybe it's the age we live in. I hadn't played it for quite a long time. But it struck out to me, and I instantly had exactly the same response you've just spoken about. Oh, I wish that wasn't there. That's untidy. And I then thought, I wonder if Matt's going to pick on that. And then I thought, no, Matt's definitely going to pick on that. Because Matt actually, in listening to the album as deeply as he does, goes through the lyrics. He's going to pick up on this. And I started to think about it, and I had to think it through, almost like think through a process in order to kind of accommodate it, which was similar to you in I kind of wish that wasn't there. It doesn't really need to be there. You could say anything at that point. I actually wondered whether it had ever generated any controversy. And I tapped up Joe Banks and said, look, in your research, you know, was this ever picked up on? And he said, actually, no, it wasn't. It was even quoted as a line in a review without any judgment being passed. And I came to see it as it being a science fiction story about somebody else. There's a lot of very troubling 1970s lyrics about people having sex with underage women. The Rolling Stones do it, Led Zeppelin do it, both in songs I like, but wish the words were otherwise. And we're not talking anything on the Ted Nugent scale of hideousness, but I think the fact that it's a story about someone else and the stories that you write about someone else, that someone else doesn't necessarily have to be a saint. So you can kind of get by, but at the same time, in exactly the same way as you, the we're tired of making love, I just kind of wish it wasn't there. We're on the same track with this.
Yeah, I feel like it's gratuitous. It doesn't help the story. I guess for me, the most generous reading of that I can give is that like the spaceman is thinking of this other person as underage and so maybe not having been with anyone else. So the idea that like, you know, the mythos of the pure maiden is there. And I was wondering if they were trying to maybe get that into one line. If so, I feel like I could kind of let it go then. But then, you know, I feel like Hawkwind doubles down on this and they talk about having an android sex doll version of this person.
I shouldn't even be laughing.
Is that, you know, but like, is that underage too? But is it okay if it's an android? But if an android is deliberately created to be a depiction of an underage person, is that still not cool? Even though the android is technically only maybe like a few years old, technically, because it got manufactured, you know, like there's a whole bunch to unpack here and none of it is fun to do because it just makes you feel like a creep for doing it.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting that these lyrics make you interrogate the scene and your thoughts about it? In a way which is actually now 45 years later, actually a clear and present issue. You know, the world that we work in, we see this happening with robotics, digital humans, personalities. I've actually seen this, like a university panel, like Oxford, etc., discuss this very issue with the advances in sex robots and kind of what this means for society. I think it's actually kind of amazing that one or two lines that Calvert writes back in 1977 give rise to these conversations, which are truly momentous societal conversations.
I completely agree. And I think that there's a lot of mid-80s Japanese work, like things like Ghost in the Shell, and, you know, going up even to contemporary times with the solid state societies that they do, even things like Ex Machina, which only came out really a few years ago. This is going to be a philosophical thing for us, for sure, that idea of what does age and sexuality and love and that kind of thing in an age of replicant humans and that kind of thing. And the idea of, like, you know, can you put your consciousness into a human? What does that mean for things? You know, like, I feel like that is going to be something that we're going to discuss more and more. So the fact it's kind of being discussed now is cool. I just don't like the way that it's done with this kind of flippancy that the Hawkwind have done. So yes, you could totally take this thing and unpack it, and it has been unpacked in lots of different ways.
It does get very dark, and in the work that I do, which is all in emerging technologies, this is stuff I've read about, and if it's of interest, they are fascinating and troubling times ahead.
So to pull us out of this quandary, the second half of the track, post that lyric, is really nice and completely different. This becomes an entirely different exploration where I feel like this is when it switches. I feel like everything that was said before was like a letter to someone. But then I feel like the singer switches and starts talking to you, the listener. It becomes this kind of like thought exercise again, like, I'm a clone. What does this mean? And this bit for me is gloriously written. Again, I think before in the previous album, we said like things like Steppenwolf made me feel like Calvert has arrived in the band. This for me is that kind of feeling where Calvert has really like got into the fabric of its DNA. There's some glorious lines in this. I feel like as well, the diction changes, the letter part. It's not sung, it's kind of dictated, but in a very staccato, almost like android kind of way. And then when the focus changes, it becomes more human. There's more emphasis. There's a little bit more singing, even though it's still fairly spoken rather than sung. The passion suddenly comes out. There's a fantastic line here of, there is no choice between us. If you had ever seen us, you'd rejoice in your uniqueness, which I really like. That is an amazing lament. The idea of, I am one of 20 other people. We've all been doing the same thing. Which then makes me feel like, are there 20 other people that they're all writing this to? Do they all have sex robots? Do they share one? What's going on? I don't know. It's weird. But, you know, the idea of like cloning someone to go out into space, we don't know why. We don't know what for. We can only speculate. But that becomes part of the interesting thing about like, I can now have that idea. In this story, we start to talk about, what does it mean to be a clone? What does it mean to feel like you don't have that individuality? Even that they say here, the idea of any weakness that you have is actually something that they would love because it would give them any kind of identity or individuality. Like even if it was something that would be seen as debilitating, that would actually make them unique. So the idea of almost wanting to have something bad happen to you just to create a feeling of individuality is another very dark thought. But again, a very human thought, the idea of not wanting to be a drone, the idea of wanting to have your individuality noticed and celebrated is the definition of love and friendship, isn't it? The idea that someone would look at you and say, yes, you are an interesting person. Out of the 7 billion people in the world, I will do activities with you, is gratifying and is nice. And the idea of losing that is probably someone's definition of hell.
I couldn't agree more. The word genius is massively overused in the world, along with words like awesome. You know, how's your cheeseburger? It's awesome. Well, no, it isn't, because if it were, you would be on your knees with your arms in the air, openly weeping. I genuinely think that there is genius in the writing of these lyrics. And the only other musician I like a lot of musicians who I genuinely think is a genius, is Frank Zappa. Those lines that you said, if you had ever seen us, you'd rejoice in your uniqueness and consider every weakness something special of your own. I genuinely see genius in that. And at the end, the last line of this, Oh, for the wings of any bird other than a battery hen. Even just saying those words on this podcast gives me goosebumps. I think that is astounding piece of lyricism. And it's also interesting as to what we said at the beginning of the show, that we've spent this time analyzing this track, and what we've been analyzing is the words. And that is the beauty, I think, of this track and of this album.
The way that the lyrics are delivered works with the theme of the track.
Yeah.
But I feel like if they'd been delivered in a more conventionally sing-songy way, you'd understand them maybe a bit more. So to have such a great lyric and to couch it in such a muffled, monotone way is crazy. Because you feel like if you wrote that line, you'd be like, I'm going to shout this from the rooftops. You know, it's,
yeah,
you know, like 7x7 or something. No, we're going to go down and I'm going to say this and everyone's going to listen to it. It's like, nope.
Yeah, the smallness of the delivery magnifies its poignancy, I think.
And also just to bring it back to being Hawkwindy, like the spirit of the age chant feels very like, you know, you shouldn't do that, that kind of feeling of the repetition, the work, like, you know, the music itself is nice, actually, you know, it rolls along. Unfortunately, I did say nice, which means that it's, you know, like it is only like 5 out of 10, and it probably is. It's a 5 out of 10 bit of music. It's perfectly fine. It carries itself over. It's kind of fine. But yeah, the lyrics are the thing which really make this an event. And again, it doesn't feel like a song. It's not a pop song. It is a story set to music, which actually, I think, goes on a lot of these tracks. These are little musical stories.
Agreed. Well, I don't know if you can hear that sound, but that is the sound of a sacred cow breathing a huge sigh of relief as it narrowly escapes its fate. Because Spirit of the Age is one of the pillars of Hawkwind songbook. It's a big crowd favorite, basically. You can imagine it kind of being a Hawkwind family sing-song. And so it goes. So a good start, particularly from a lyrical point of view. And it takes us somewhere pretty dark. Damnation Alley.
Yeah, this I really like because it's dark, but again, couched in a way where if you're not paying attention, you would think it's actually really fun. You know, like it's another long intro. The radio comes back in, the kind of like the howling wind comes back in, which I kind of liked because given the annoying, problematic part of the first track of the album, I kind of felt like I could almost pretend this was the first track because it has a nice intro to it. And then I'm like, cool, I like this track. I think the first time I listened to this, again, not being able to get every single lyric, I wasn't quite sure where it was going. And I thought, oh, this is surprisingly upbeat for Hawkwind. And it wasn't until, again, I really listened to it properly that I realized that this is a song that revels spectacularly in its own irony, which I think is a really cool thing for it to be able to do. To take the US open road trucking kind of song, you know, like the way that the chords work, the upbeat feeling of the whole thing, and then twist that into an apocalyptic drive through destroyed America is a great bit, again, of cognitive dissonance. And I'm sure that was even better during the time. It feels like Mad Max or something, you know? I feel like this person is having a kind of a good time in a way where they've accepted their apocalypse. You know what I mean? It's like that mixed with Zombieland or something, you know, that idea of we've gone through so many apocalyptic films, we may as well just have some fun with it now. So this idea of this person in again, a great delivery of 8-wheeled anti-radiation tomb is a great idea. It feels very Mad Max. I feel like someone's got like a big truck, has just welded spikes and stuff, you know, all the way to it in a kind of like, you know, Mad Max Carmageddon kind of way. And it's just driving through what's left of America. But it's like, if I'm still alive, I'm going to be enjoying this as much as I can. And this is my song. I think that the way this rolls along is the first time where you're really introduced to the rest of the bandmates. The bass here is more like old Lemmy kind of feeling, like you can hear it a lot more, like it's got like a big like sort of thumping twang to it. The bass line actually walks up and down a lot and really hits the chord changes, which is really nice. It's almost like it's not the drums that do the fills, it's actually the bass kind of like comes up, hits that note and then wanders back down again. And I really like that feeling that we're on this up feeling all the time. It just adds to the fun of the piece and just adds to the pace of the piece, but I think is also then very faithful to the kind of music. So it's very well studied in order to subvert it as well as it does, which then brings me into the second half of this track, which just like Steppenwolf makes me feel like I'm really glad that this part of Hawkwind hasn't gone anywhere. You know, I was worried after so many people left in this band genocide that happened at the end of the last album. And I think that Steppenwolf the band enjoyed. So the fact that this kind of works again is fine. You know, there aren't so many long meandering instrumentals in this album at all. So obviously that bit is kind of gone. But this breakdown, like they did with Steppenwolf, is absolutely glorious. It just rolls along and then just falls into itself. The organ out of nowhere, it was just like the very first time I heard it, that was a real just like hairs up. This is something that does it for me. When that's done well, I absolutely love. And this track, it's great. I've been listening to it again. The bass, it has a long tail to it as it goes along. And then as it breaks down, the decay of the bass cut till it becomes like tiny little stabs. And then this organ comes in and the bass and the organ just come together and just hit these notes, which are just absolutely sublime. Every time it comes on, I'm just so happy. I have to stop what I'm doing and just listen to it and really appreciate it. And then it rolls on and the bass, the notes in it are so satisfying as the organ just kind of like layers on top. And then in comes the violin, and whoever is playing the violin,
Simon House.
Right. Simon House is not getting paid enough for the amount of value that he brings to the band for me. I just like every time he's been playing, like the last album, this album, whenever that violin comes in, it just gets me. There's something about the way that they layer it over is just always so serene and really, really gorgeous. It's funny how this breakdown makes me forget the rest of the track until it comes back again for the reprise. I'm like, oh yeah, this isn't a different track. This is the same track. So for it to be like a big, long exploration, have this really fun, well, you know, fun in quotes, delivery, where they're even listing all the places in America which aren't there anymore. And I feel like listing places in America, again, is very of the style. So again, taking that and instead of being like, you know, on my way to Chattanooga or whatever, it's like, nope, Chattanooga isn't there anymore. It's like a great twist, again, on the expectations. I don't think I have a criticism for this track. I just think that it's absolutely gorgeous and just probably one of my favorite things that they've done.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Joe Banks actually says something great in his book, Days of the Underground, about the bridge in the middle section of this, where he says, as the machine breaks down, House appears like a master mechanic to save the day, extemporizing around a block of organ chords, his keening violin combining gorgeously with the driving rhythms. Damnation Alley lacks the fuzzy logic and cosmic density of their earlier output, but its sleek lines and curves are confident and purposeful. This is a band moving forward still, paralleling both punk's directness and the contemporary krautrock's growing sophistication. Which I think kind of says it all. It is a brilliant thing. Simon House, like, honestly don't think in all the music I like that there is any violin in rock music that I actually look forward to in the same way that I'm excited about Simon House and his playing. It's no surprise he went on to play with people like David Bowie. Like, the man is a class act and really brings the vibes. Again, the lyrics are wonderful. And this time the lyrics are kind of wonderful because of the meter and the way they really kind of fit the meter he's singing in, such as, you know, no more Arizona, now Phoenix is fried up, Oklahoma City, what a pity it's gone. They're just words that I look forward to hearing, basically. So yeah, totally with you. This is a brilliant piece of Hawkwind music. And one that, with the kind of extended breakdown, this one never outstays its welcome. It's kind of there. It does its job perfectly for quite a long time, but it doesn't feel like a long time because it's kind of perfect and to the point.
The lyrics are written to the music really nicely. This goes back to things like you shouldn't do that. Well, like, even just like, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do that. There's a feeling of like, almost like you're sounding like an old railway engine or something when you do it, you know, like the chanting, the lyrics never feel like they are not integrated, you know, and the fact that so much of this hits the beats and there's a very definite measure of staccato pointing through all this, even the way it's delivered. Like, if you try and sing along with this, you're out of breath. It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Armor-plated angel, motor, pony, express. Those have been selected so those syllables hit in that really staccato way, which is just really nice.
Doing that live, running around on stage, must have been insanely hard.
With a sword as well.
With a sword, indeed. So you would never criticize him for it. It then goes into something of a very, very different tone and feel, but which feels like something of a coda or an epilogue to the previous track, which is Fable of a Failed Race.
Which I was not expecting on this record after the people who had gone, I thought maybe wouldn't get this, but there's singing on this. So maybe they were like, that's the compromise. It's like, you can do your ponderous spacey thing that we've done before, so long as I get to sing over it.
Yeah, we've never heard Calvert do this before, have we? He's always had that kind of punky spoken staccato delivery, but here he is actually singing and emoting.
Yeah, and it feels very emotive. Like, this one, I really had to look up the lyrics because I thought there has to be something going on here. There aren't many lyrics, but all these lyrics are fantastic. Again, this for me is like one of those sci-fi allegories that we could say. It's got the same spacey vibes as Spiral Galaxy or Chronoguide Skyway to me. So it hits me in the right kind of spot sonically. But when the lyrics start to layer over, there is this wistfulness in the tone. The delivery of the vocals has this sadness, but also a kind of feeling of acceptance in a way. And when you listen to the lyrics themselves, all of that just tells a fantastic story. Every line influences the next. Even the idea of like, once was green and is all now sand, the sand buried them up, you know, so it's not just like, oh, it's sand, that sucks, because sand's like, you know, infertile and lame. So no, sand is also a trap. And then the symbolic idea of like being buried up to your eyes, so all you can do is look up and then maybe I have hope, but then shadow came for our sight and left us to conspire with night. I was wondering whether or not like that meant that like something like took their sun away, or maybe it physically removed their eyes. I don't think it really matters, but that idea of something happening and either it just happened naturally or they brought it upon themselves, but everything that they had that was lush and green and verdant and great got turned into something disastrous.
To me, this actually is directly a follow-on from Damnation Alley. Like, to me, Damnation Alley is this post-apocalyptic landscape, but it's kind of exciting and people bumming around in the big tanks and this guy's having kind of fun with it, as we expressed. And it's kind of exciting. This feels like it's like thousands of years hence and is very melancholic. Like, look what we did. This used to be green. And there's that sense of it to me. So it's beautiful to me in terms of the sequencing of the album that this follows directly after Damnation Alley.
Yeah, the fact it's called Fable of a Failed Race sets up the point of it. There is something around the idea of what was great was lost, and the loss of it became something that physically trapped us. Again, whether or not that's like metaphorically they were trapped, or whether or not they were, you know, literally trapped. So all they could do was look up as they were trapped. And then even that hope from the sky actually only brought something else, you know, like shadow wings sounds like a kind of like a predator or something came for them. So there was a feeling of like when something really bad happened, they weren't in a position to protect themselves because of what they'd done to themselves. So they'd set themselves up for this terrible fate. And it's sad, but like I said, it's delivered in a way which sounds almost accepting, you know, which makes me feel like maybe these people, this failed race did something that they like, yeah, we shouldn't have done that. You know, like, this is our fault. It wasn't a natural disaster, or it wasn't a warring army. It was like, you know, maybe it was something like an atom bomb kind of thing where they just did something terrible. And they're like, we are now the architects of our own destruction. And now something else has happened that we maybe would have been able to deal with before, but we can't, because now we're stuck. And being stuck means that we are unable to defend ourselves. The conspire is a nice word at the end, to conspire with night. It doesn't mean they're at peace with it. Conspire almost feels like maybe they're going to become the next evil thing because night has arrived. Maybe they have to fight with it, but you know, conspire means that they're kind of on its side. So again, this maybe feels like maybe that's the accepting tone. It's like maybe they were scared at the beginning and now they're like, we've been doing this for a long time. There's this feeling for this a little bit like almost like early Star Trek or something. You know how like, you know, the ship would arrive on a planet and something weird would happen, but someone would say, we've been doing this for thousands of years. So you're like, oh, well, it's a, you know, it's a tradition and we've just arrived and now we're going to hear your story and try and help solve it in 45 minutes. This feels a little bit like that, you know, like us as a listener have happened on a failed race and this is their song about everything that's happened to them. This is like, let us tell you about our civilization in 8 lines, squidge. And now it's just us to like, just to try and like unpack all that. But, you know, there's a lot to unpack and it's really nicely delivered.
Absolutely. And the sense of melancholy in the words is beautifully underpinned musically.
Yeah, the only thing that gave maybe a feeling of hope was the idea of conspiring with night felt like a reference to the logbook, the first page of which is about that person who is stuck in a self-perpetuating night. And, you know, he's trapped in darkness and, you know, that idea of them coming to the realization that maybe something can be done about this. And they say, let there be light, and there is. That idea of like reconjuring the light, that idea of remembering what it's like to be happy and have light and be able to try and force that back into reality. When I read the word conspire, I was thinking like, maybe they aren't trapped. Maybe there is a way for them to reattain salvation if they remember what it's like to have the light. And then that will be their conspiracy. They'll conspire with night in order to make light happen once again. So maybe they're not as failed as we think they are.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting also how the lyrics are such that you get the same vibe and feel out of it, but you can interpret them very differently. My take was always that the failed race was us. It was a lament for humanity. And the conspire with night was basically going, this is something that we had our own part in, rather than something that was done to us.
Like the first track, maybe these are the people who went from Earth to try and settle somewhere else, but mess it up, and now they're stuck where they are. You know, there's ways you can do that, and you can definitely attribute it to humanity. I just like to dissect it from a more allegorical kind of way.
And the words let you do that. Mm. The words totally let you do that. So that rounds out side one, which is a pretty good side by anybody's standards. Definitely some great stuff to get into there. We put the needle down on side two, and we hit a completely different tone. This is about as poppy as Hawkwind get. And it is the title track, Quark, Strangeness and Charm.
Yeah. I have a feeling this might be a sacred cow as well. And it's one which is not going to survive as well as the other one, at least for me. It starts with a slid bass note. And there's something about that bass note that tells me everything I need to know about this track. I don't think I can think of anything which starts with a slid guitar note that doesn't then end up being a little bit dumb. It sounds like the same thing that like that Dick Dale track, the one that's on Pulp Fiction, where it goes do, and then you have same kind of slide. And I'm just like, that track's poppy and silly. And it just made me feel like the same kind of thing. I likened this to half I Like Driving in My Car by Madness and half Lily the Pink by The Scaffold, which is not a combination I feel is going to do anyone any favors. The point of the song is kind of lost to me. I know it's, again, imaginative and silly and weird, but I find this one a lot harder to get into. I think the problem for me is that strangeness and charm are two personal attributes or attributes to personality that you can have. And Quark is an object, like, you know, it's a thing. It's like a subatomic particle. So like having two personality traits and then an object is weird, even if it's a more scientific object. I mean, you could say bread, strangeness and charm for all the sense it makes to me. And I think that's the thing that really like doesn't help this for me. I can't interpret this in a way which makes me happy to understand why Quark is there as the main leading point in this song. And so that's what trips me up constantly.
Fair. I mean, it is definitely is a novelty. To me, it's Calvert in particular just having a lot of fun.
Right.
And the kind of music supporting that. It's not something we've really heard from Hawkwind. I'm trying to think back, but I think this is very different territory for Hawkwind, not one they inhabit very often. I liked it from the off, but then I've had this album for a long, long time. It was one of the first ones I got, and probably to young me, this is a very accessible track. All the tracks on the album, this is one that you get because you don't have to think too hard. And therefore, I've grown up liking the album. So it's the track because of that. Because it's very different now, I think, coming at it from the point of view that you do, which, let's face it, it's the point of the pod. So it's kind of fascinating that it rather sticks out in a mood-breaking way between the depth of what we've had before. It's good, I think, where they put it on the album, because I think on side one, it would have been completely disingenuous. And at least as a kickoff to side two, it's almost like the song that gets played in the interval between the two halves of the album, because it gets pretty serious from here again after this and pretty deep. So I totally get where you're coming from. I do, again, like the cleverness of the lyrics. You know, he had a long moustache to put on. It was yellow. It's a line that always makes me smile. And I like it. But it definitely doesn't carry like weight or gravitas as a lot of the other tracks do. But I definitely feel better about it than you do. But I do get where you're coming from.
There's vocal flair for sure. There's some nice rhymes in it. There is some fun with it. And I'm sure that there's someone listening to the podcast now shouting at their speakers saying, look, it's just fun. It's just a bit of fun. Just like chill with it. And I say, that's fine. but it's not my fault that Hawkwind just put three very heavy tracks at the beginning that require detailed listening and then put this in it. When if I'm in that frame of mind and I apply the same logic to it, it's not my fault if I then come up with something that's unsatisfying to me. And you're right. Like they said with the review, sometimes Calvert's insane sense of humor takes over, and I think it's fine. But this track for me is the equivalent of him appearing with a stuffed bird. You know, I'm like, fine, you can do that, but I'm not enjoying it in the same way that you are. I feel like he is having an awful lot of fun, but I feel like not that he's having fun at my expense, but he's having fun and I don't get the joke. I think the one thing that's good about this track is that it's actually mercifully short. You know, it's only like 3 or so minutes. You know, if this went on for like 8 minutes, like they have been known to do, then I would be really annoyed with it. But the fact it's short, I'm like, yeah, fine. It's a bit of a jam. I was wondering even whether or not this track was trying to be the next Silver Machine, just because I feel like the production is high. There's lots of instrumentation. It's super fun. I feel like this would be radio friendly. Okay, the lyrics are still weird, but it's almost like Hawkwind saying, look, society, we'll meet you halfway. Let us have strange lyrics and a weird idea. If we give you a bit of a groovy jam to do it to, are you happy with that? And I'm wondering whether or not they tried to do that and it didn't really work, but that would be my suspicion.
I would absolutely say that you're 100% right in them looking for another Silver Machine, because I think they kept trying to look for another Silver Machine ever since Silver Machine and totally failed to do it at every turn.
Yeah, because Silver Machine was great, but the fact it did so well was they found Lemmy and, you know, they tried to do it so much, they eventually made it work. I don't think it's good when Hawkwind try and write a hit. I think that it comes over as them trying a bit hard, and I feel like this track feels kind of try hard.
No, I think that's fair.
The one thing that is nice about this track, though, is that this gives the rhythm section a chance to really, like, shine. The drums had a good go in Damnation Alley, but I feel like this rhythm section has a lot of energy in it. You know, it's filled with claps and cymbals and that kind of stuff. So if anything that's nice about this, it really does carry itself well, and the rhythm section really helps drive it.
Well said. Let's end on a note of positivity for Quark, Strangers and Charm. I love it, but I totally understand where you're coming from. And it'd be interesting to see what anybody out there listening has to say about it.
Anyone is welcome to fight me in the comments section about that one. That's fair enough. And I would love to be proved wrong if someone does have like an interpretation, or if enough people say, stop interpreting it, this is just a fun one that they put on the album. The way that Hawkwind have arranged albums before, I'm completely fine with that. I just feel like if we're analyzing it like we are, this one doesn't stand up to the same level of scrutiny as the other tracks. And also, I don't think it's not so fun that I let it get away with not being that.
Just because it's intended to be a bit of fun doesn't necessarily mean that you have to find it fun and that you have to enjoy it. It's all, at the end of the day, completely subjective, and things kind of connect with you or they don't. With this one, the impact has to be immediate. It's like a joke that you either laugh at or you don't really understand. Retelling the joke because you didn't get it makes it less funny than it was the first time, unless you do what Stuart Lee does and you just keep retelling it for half an hour, so that the act of retelling it badly just makes it funny. So I think this is one of those things that you hear it and you love it, or you hear it and it doesn't work for you, and it's concise and short and it only has one note to play, and you either dig it or you don't, and that's totally fair.
The one thing that I will give it for is that I think it's probably the only track which is like an Einstein diss piece. I don't think anyone has ever gone for Einstein over his looks.
It's a little unfair because Einstein is not in a position where he has the right of reply. I would have enjoyed Einstein's lengthy white paper on exactly why he had in fact scored with many girls and would continue to do so. Thank you very much. We get from this light-hearted behaviour into probably, I would say, in terms of subject matter, one of the heaviest songs that Hawkwind have done, because it is very direct, it is very of the time, the kind of issues that were going on at the time, it's still going on today, it is very prescient, which is Hassan Isaba. And I'm going to tee this up with a couple of things. Firstly, a beautiful piece here that Joe Banks talks about Hassan Isaba, when he says, "The finger bells and quasi Arabic violin at the start of Hassan Isaba may be blatant exoticism, but they conjure images of Bedouin tents and veiled harems nonetheless. There's some teasing foreshadowing of the song's main theme, some villainous organ, and then its big Eastern-flavoured riff crashes in. Calvert chants frenziedly over the top, conflating an ancient Islamic warrior creed with the present-day Middle East of oil feeds, petrodollars, and Black September. His analysis isn't exactly nuanced, but it's a potent reminder of 70s headlines about the oil crisis, the Yom Kippur War, Palestinian terrorism, and endless plane hijackings, all of which retain a queasy prescience today. Now, Black September is referred to there, and anybody who wasn't news aware in the 70s might not know what this term is. Matt particularly wasn't aware. I was obviously far too young to be aware of this. So for anyone who doesn't know, Black September is also known as the Jordanian Civil War, which was a conflict fought in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan between the Jordan Armed Forces and the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1970. It is also the name adopted by a militant Palestinian organization, which was founded around the same time. And if anybody knows the story of the Munich massacre, where the Israeli athletes and the West German policemen who were killed during the 1972 Summer Olympics, they were carried out by Black September. So it's just kind of worth knowing why Calvert shouts Black September through this track. He doesn't explain it or expand on it at all. He just shouts Black September, but that's why. So that takes us into Hassan e-Saba. And Matt, how did you come to this?
Removing context for a second, sonically, I think this track is really my kind of track. It's the first time we've felt this vibe since we heard Magnu, I feel like. You know, Magnu had some of that Eastern desert rock kind of stuff before. This is that even more so. And as your quote said, that idea of the kind of, I called it xylophone, but yeah, finger bells, that kind of thing, like, it immediately adds a sense of sinister theatricality to the track, which, like you said, instantly evokes feelings of deserts and of, like, for me, it's night skies with twinkling lights and that idea of people like moving through endless wastelands and that kind of thing. I like the instruments used to make this. I like the lilt and the sway of the tracks. I do find that kind of sound really great. There's a reason why desert rock is something we bonded over. There's, you know, that idea of the minor keys, the kind of like ending on these kind of like drawn, more sinister feeling notes. For me, this has proto Tool, Porcupine Tree, Opeth, that kind of feeling that we've talked about before. I can really feel the influence of this kind of thing on more contemporary acts. Also, the mystical intro with the finger bells and the fiddle and everything, the transition to the guitar is really nice. We set the tone and now we're going to bring in our rock part. It's really nice. It's really effective. You know, like, there's an instant kind of head nod to it. Even if, like, the subject matter is still kind of like very heavy, the music itself carries itself, you know, really nicely. If this was just an instrumental, I think it would still be really good, you know, and I think that's a tribute to the track. The way things are delivered feels very like the original Hawkwind stuff. Again, I'm going to say you shouldn't do that again, but that feeling of like the chanting, the rhythmic repetition of all this has that very kind of classic, well-rehearsed Hawkwind feel to it. I love the echo on the snare drum. It just adds this pounding rhythm to the whole piece. It just has this feeling of like moving forward, that bang, which just has this tail to it. Yeah, solid riff, roaring drums, well sung, rhythmic chanting. I feel like the only thing it's missing to somehow make it like a full Hawkwind track is having any kind of synth influence on it at all. But this is completely synth removed, which is rare now for Hawkwind. So to have this feeling very rocky maybe feels a bit more punk, because I feel like most punk records are normally like someone shouting, someone with a guitar, someone with half a drum kit, and you're done. They didn't have the budget normally to be able to get and plug and balance a synthesizer. In terms of the content, I didn't know who Hassan e-Saba was. I had to Google that to find out he was a, you know, mystical assassin from a long time ago. Given the fact that the Afghan war is just quote unquote ended, even though it, you know, kind of hasn't, it's just entered stage three. You know, like, this is an interesting time to be listening to this, just because of that idea of like talking about infidels, talking about oil, talking about the Western pillage of the Arab countries. Yeah, it's much more poignant now. I guess like a Western band being critical, therefore, of the West, I can imagine that was pretty controversial then, in the same way it's kind of controversial now. Listening to this now, we've kind of gone through that kind of like, you know, there was a kind of like a 90s, early 2000s thing where like all the films had Arabian terrorists, but then like the New York Times articles comes out, the documentaries come out, you know, people like chill out for a second. 9/11 was a long time ago. People realized that that was much more complex than anyone thought. It wasn't just like, yeah, we're going to attack this country for no reason. You know, everyone has has a lot more information. So like people are a lot more critical of it. So to listen to this now, it feels more like Hawkwind were on the right side of history.
Yeah, very much so. It doesn't really expound on the concepts that he's putting forward in the track. It's just kind of obvious from the music. This is one of those cases where the music does the job of expanding on the lyrics. You know what the feeling is because this is what the music does. It's interesting also, earlier you referenced Adrian Shaw's bass as kind of giving you thoughts of Lemmy, because this, I think, is the most bass-driven track that Hawkwind have done for many albums. The massive burst, jolt of adrenaline that you get when this first kicks in, but then in particular, when it kicks back in at the end, after the breakdown in the middle, is all to do with that rolling bass. And for that reason, I think it's a huge live track, as you can imagine. In fact, you remembered a little bit from vague memories of it being played at one of the gigs that you went to. It's still a huge live track. Incredibly, they went through a phase in the 80s of introducing this track as Assassins of Allah, which again is something I'm not sure you would do today. But a absolutely brilliant track with another fantastic piece of Simon House violin. It's incredible to think of a song that's as kind of as aggressive and driven as this. Yeah, this is definitely one of the standout pieces, not just of this album, but of Hawkwind in general, I think.
Full of cows, this album, actually.
Full of cows. Yep, this is a field, definitely, this album. It takes us to something interesting, which is another of those little interludes that Hawkwind have of instrumental music. And this actually feels slightly industrial, which I guess is a giveaway from the title, The Forge of Vulcan.
Yeah, I thought this track was almost to make up for the lack of synth in the previous track. They're like, sorry, we didn't have any synth in that track. Here's a lot of it right away. But no, I love the sound of this synth. It's smooth, it's flowing, it's characterful. It just sounds rich and gorgeous. Yeah, this track is very me, but just with my electronic sensibilities. I was listening to this thinking like, this is gorgeous. I think also this feels like the first time that Hawkwind is like experimenting maybe with synthesized drums. There's a kind of filtered skittering sound at the top, which sounds a little bit like noise or like wind, but it's cut up. So it sounds almost like it's a little hi-hat pattern. And I'm pretty sure that that was made by high passing some kind of synth and sequencing it. So it feels like it's the first time that they've really experimented with synthesized percussion, which is interesting. And then I love the fact that that is then counterpointed with the metal clang, which is obviously real. You can feel those two things being hit together. You know, I guess there's like a mix of the idea of forging, the idea of metal hitting, and that clang clang, just, I love it. It's just a bit like, I think in the last album, I was saying that there are those two chords, which we're just pulling that track together, which I liked. Here again, it just feels like it's just dang, 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 dang. There's a rhythm to it, which again, you can get into. For me, repetitive electronic music is like my favorite thing still. So the fact that this adds that kind of like repetitive beat to it, it's just really nice. I love the fact it offsets so nicely the organic sound with the synthesized sound. I always think there's a really nice counterpoint to that. And this track just builds and builds. You know, the richer chords come in, they build, they just sear through the piece. They're large, they're textural. They just like add these strong like layers of sound. It's almost like you can pick apart the kind of striations of this track, almost like a piece of like sedimentary rock. As you cut into it, you can just see how everything just layers and layers and layers to make this amazing just feeling at the end. It's not very long, but it's absolutely exactly the right length it needs to be to kind of make me feel like I want to play it again. Yeah, this track right after the other one is just a great Hawkwind sandwich of just like, this is us when we do rock really well, this is us when we do synth really well. We split them up, but they kind of make this great 1-2 punch.
Yeah, very much so. And a really nice little synth loop going on in here. It's so easy to make synth loops. It's so hard to make synth loops that sound brilliant in the context and really deliver the context that you're trying to work them in.
I think it was this track that actually inspired me to put Don't You Know, the Ian Hammer track, into the sessions.
All right.
This loop is faster, but if you took this loop, slowed it down by about half, that's about where Ian Hammer is. And again, that idea, like you said, about like making a good synth riff that you can stand to hear and feel comfortable with over like 3 to 4 minutes is not an easy thing to do.
Absolutely. And the kind of industrial thing of this really kind of, again, foretells things that are going to be coming our way in a few years' time. It's funny, I used to listen to the more instrumental parts of this album as though they were just bridges between the tracks that I loved. And coming back to the album earlier this year, I find that they all take on a kind of equal resonance with me now. And I love the instrumental kind of breakdowns and these instrumental pieces that they do as much as I love the vocal stuff on this album. The next track is a really interesting one, Days of the Underground, obviously the track that provided the title for Joe Banks' book, Radical Experimentation in the Age of Paranoia. And this track kind of feels a bit like a eulogy for those days.
It feels like a letter from Hawkwind to the new young upstart bands, kind of reminding them almost like of Hawkwind's underground credentials, you know, that kind of idea of like, yeah, we were there. I haven't really seen this happen before in rock bands that I can think of, at least for me, but this happens quite a lot with hip hop acts. Like after they've done a few albums, there's a lot of hip hop acts that then go back and talk about where they came from as an almost kind of a defense from like new people coming up saying like, oh, you're past it. You're not real anymore. You're not in the streets. Dilated Peoples did a track about where they came from. Jurassic 5 had Concrete Streets. Hilltop Hoods had this whole thing about the industry. So it's interesting to hear that. And almost like the fact that this riff is very repetitious almost has a kind of hip hop thing to it, because you're not really thinking about the music in this. The music is carrying again the story, and the story is the main point of this. So I guess let's get into that. The opening lyrics sound like a band almost like kind of coming online. You know, they talk about like their acid mind expansion. So that goes back very much to the, almost the first album where they said without acid. Now they're just like, nah, acid's fine. But that idea of like they saw through delusion and brain box pollution, you know, there's a lot of great rhymes in here. But, you know, the whole point about this is the fact that they were at street level. They knew that they were going to fight, but they weren't going to fight with bricks and, you know, Molotovs. They were going to fight with sound. They were going to have their message. The idea of like drowning the institution with sound and like, you know, like playing sound louder than they could speak was a good way of protesting. There's this interesting idea as well that we're like, we didn't have to fight too much because it was already falling apart. I think is very observant of that. You know, like it's kind of where punk is as well, when they're saying like, you know, like the fall of the middle class, the breaking of things, the fact that like globalization had become much more warlike. There wasn't any much peace and love anymore that had been taken. There's a lot of feeling of like, wait a minute. If you look outside, there's a lot of things going on, which we have no say in, which we're not happy about. But at the same time, people weren't able to keep people who were making trouble under control, you know, and they were breaking out. There were riots and fights. There were punks saying like, well, you know what, the police aren't supporting the right people. They're keeping the man down rather than like helping like keep the peace and that kind of thing. So there was this idea of like, you know, yeah, crumbling, fumbling, critical stuff. And there's something almost even worse in a way by them not saying like, yeah, we fought. They were like, they were falling apart anyway. We just gave them a push. You know, that's just like brutal in the way they attack the state. The fact that you say that the state that you're part of is just useless is, it's just somehow, it's that kind of idea of like, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed. You know, that kind of thing that just hurts more somehow.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's my reading of this track, and in coming back to it, hasn't changed, is that this is very wistful. Weren't those amazing days? Look at the things we did. You know, the spirit of revolution was in the air and with people, but now deeply melancholic. It came to nothing. You know, whatever happened to those chromium heroes? Are there any of them still left around? It's like, we did it all. We fought the law and the law won. And like, here we are. And Calvert has said of this track that this is him basically explaining why there will never be a revolution in England, which is interesting. It has that kind of wistfulness looking back. And again, some of the lyrics are, you know, beautiful in here. And again, I think you could almost take all the music out, just read this. And Calvert did have a book of poetry. I've got it somewhere. I seem to have lost it. I need to get it again, called Centigrade 232. And some of the lyrics in this album are drawn from it. You could just read this as a poem, as a eulogy to the counterculture of the 1960s, which now by 1977, it's kind of gone away. Hawkwind are the last men standing from that era and are trying to do something. I definitely have those emotions of kind of wistfulness and melancholy when I hear this.
Yeah, I agree. I think towards the end of the track, they almost turn their melancholy on themselves.
Yeah.
But they said, you know, they didn't need machine guns. They were doing messaging. And they talk about, you know, some of the people who they lost, they didn't lose them in combat. It feels like you almost lost them to either the system or to apathy or to, you know, like that kind of thing. Like when they say, like, you know, they offered us contracts, we said we don't need them. That's almost them saying, like, you know, like the industry tried to get them, but they were like, no, we're going to do our own thing. But I feel like they list a couple of people who maybe did get a contract and did get lost. You know, the idea of Smiley Michael, his black motorcycle got eaten by rust because it wasn't driven anymore. You know, so he stopped being a Hell's Angel, or he stopped being like a rebel. Again, just like Hawkwind's brilliant use of mental imagery, you know, they could have said Smiley Michael was lame and just stopped coming to gigs, but he didn't. They talked about something which was iconic of Rebellion, the idea of a black motorcycle, and just using the word rust conjures up, well, why was it rusted? Because of lack of use. You know, like you can get a huge amount of detail into those lines, and it's nice to see lyrics which make you work for the conclusion. Like good advertising for me, like, you know, being in the industry, when you actually read a good headline where you're like, oh, someone spent time because now I've read that, now I've thought about it, now I've solved it, now I feel clever for doing that. That kind of, they call it the 1+1=3 way of storytelling. You give them two things, you miss out something, but you add the extra thing. The idea of the motorcycle being eaten by rust means that you have to fill in the time between being told there's a motorcycle, being told it's rusted. You do everything in between that. And in so doing, you apply your own context, your own feelings about that. The other one's a bit more of a head twister. The idea of John the Bog dreamt that he was asleep at the wheel, but when he woke up, it was real. So like he dreamt he was asleep, but then he was asleep. Too late to have sussed makes me feel like he probably did manage to kill himself by accident by being asleep at the wheel. Either that or he was asleep at the wheel in a kind of metaphorical way.
Which is how I take it. Yeah, it's like, you know, he thought he was out of control and then he woke up and he was out of control. You know, something happened to wake him up and he realized it is, you know, he wasn't in control of what was going on. I don't know what that means, but that's how I've taken that line.
And Jeff, the poet who wrote with a spray can, somehow, I don't know why, but feels very, again, evocative to me. I like Jeff. Jeff sounds cool. A poet who writes with a spray can is just a nice phrase again. And again, the way that this track is delivered, there's inferences all the way through this, which really help bring out the life in the piece. Like to read it as I am right now, just looking at it on my screen, like it still reads well, but to read it in the right way, it brings a lot extra to it, you know, really brings it to life.
I totally agree. That line was a poet who wrote with a spray can. That always had the same impact on me as the line in The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel, the words of the prophets written on the subway wall. There's a kind of profundity to that that kind of hits you. Yeah, I love that. And the music for this does a great job of just kind of propelling it along. And there's another synth loop that comes in that underpins this. That feeling for me of the kind of wistfulness and melancholia, as the track fades out, only the synth loop remains. And the synth loop, for me, really carries that wistful, melancholic sense.
Yeah, which actually then travels into the next track to the point where I didn't realize that track had finished. It wasn't actually until I'd really paid attention to the track listing that I realized this wasn't just like a coda to the whole track. And I guess it is a coda, but they've just made it something else. The little kind of floaty synth is really nice. I feel like they've done a lot to change the attack of the synth, you know, like, so when you press the key, it doesn't just jump up, it kind of slowly rises. And that just helps with that feeling of more kind of like wistfulness, you know, with the idea of the fade coming in and just adds to that kind of like twinkly feeling to it. And I don't know quite how to feel about this track because it's one of those little Hawkwind bits that's kind of a shame, but it's actually a really nice track. And I think it's actually a kind of a nice way of finishing because it almost feels like if you told a Sonic story over the last two tracks, if this was like the days of the underground, I almost feel like this could be someone who's almost cornered, running from the authorities, and they're just like telling everyone that they can, like, this was the days of the underground, this is what it was all about. And then suddenly in comes this great, moody, dramatic track with big organs and moody riffs and kicking drums. It almost feels like the authorities found him. You know, I can almost feel like this person at the end of an alley with a wall, and they just turn around and there's all the people in their suits and the masks and they're all walking. And I feel like this would be the anthem of the people creeping up. Like if this was a radio play and you were like, they're after us. And then this track came in, you'd be like, oh, you are screwed.
I totally agree. It's almost uncanny you've come to that conclusion, because when I listen to this, to me, the Days of the Underground is this wistful melancholy about the values they had and what they lived for and these days of rebellion. And then the Iron Dream is almost, this is the grim reality of the present that has absolutely stamped on that dream that you had and killed it. And is almost like the end credit scene of a movie, you know, where the big bad thing kind of looms at the end, basically, and it means that you leave the theater with a sense of foreboding.
This feels like a Twilight Zone episode, you know, the ones where you don't win all the time. And it always has that saying at the end, which is like, be careful because this might happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This feels like that. That, yeah, if this came in, you're like, oh yeah, all those decisions were really bad and those people are in trouble now. So yeah, I completely agree with you. This is actually a very effective way of ending the album in a way which does put your teeth on edge. Even though it fades, it's kind of fine because it's already kind of made its point. And I feel like, you know, like even the title, The Iron Dream, it's not their dream. It's the dream of like of the rest of the world right now. You know, I feel like Iron Dream feels like Iron Curtain, feels like Berlin Wall.
Yeah, mechanization.
Yeah, so I feel like there's nothing good about The Iron Dream for them, at least. I mean, they could have called it The Iron Nightmare, but I feel like that might have been too leading. So to call it The Iron Dream is actually a little bit more subtle because then it lets the music do the talking and tell you what kind of dream it is. I take it almost as part of the previous track to make the point. Listening to this track in isolation wouldn't help. It needs the rest of the piece to really like bring it together. But I can imagine like Sabbath, for example, would use this track at the start of an album to set the tone and then play with it. Hawkwind have used this at the end of the album, so you now have to deal with it and like go out into the rest of your life after listening to the album with this as the last thing in your brain. Then maybe then like you looking around and being like, okay, what's wrong? What can I talk about? This is the weirdest analogy I've come up with probably, but it feels like the Lorax, like, you know, when all the trees are dead and then there's that one like thing saying unless, and there's that feeling of like the one last seed. You could almost feel like this song is the gift to the imaginative listener who's listened to all of this. And it's kind of like, this sound can be what comes for you unless you do something, like unless you go back to the underground, unless you try and like, you know, fight for something. And you, if you don't want this, then it can be quite motivating. You know, this is the Hawkwind's unless seed.
That's well said. There's going to be a few people Googling that one. Nice work. I like it. Some homework for you out there. It's funny, isn't it, how there's a few of these, this album that kind of work in pairs like that. You know, Damnation Alley, Fable of a Failed Race, the beautiful kind of juxtaposition musically of Hassani Saba and the Forge of Vulcan, and now the Days of the Underground and the Iron Dream that just seem to work as a pair really nicely to round this out. So those are the tracks of the album, and a pretty deep conversation that was. Now, we're going to take a look at that cover. So the cover of the album, and this is very different for Hawkwind, and it should be, because this is a cover by Hypnosis. And in this case, Hypnosis is not just another pseudonym for Barney Bubbles. This is actually the Hypnosis made famous by those Pink Floyd covers of Photographic Stuff. And this is the inside of Battersea Power Station. It's actually Control Room B of Battersea Power Station. And that speaks volumes. It's quite evocative.
It is. I think given the subject matter and the return to reality in a way, and the criticisms of reality that the band bring to this album, I feel like having something that looks more real helps. You know, like it helps you ground yourself. Like, we're not fantasy. We're not looking at like, you know, people gazing over cosmic voids. We're not looking at crashed spaceships. We're looking at science writ large. Our own kind of technical Leviathan, you know, like there's readings and dials that you assume do something, but you have no idea quite what. Lots of pressure gauges and lots of dials. And I feel like there's always something sinister when you have readouts and you don't really know what they do. There's something just immediately exclusionary to you. You feel like you're not au fait or smart enough to understand what it is. I think this comes a lot from TV and stuff, but there's always that worry that if you press a button, you might make everything explode.
Yeah. And people seemingly asleep on the job, which is always a worrying precedent to set. It's interesting you're talking about science writ large, because actually the title of the album, for some people might not know, a quark, as Matt said, is a subatomic particle. It's the smallest. Protons are made up of quarks, three of them in a general rule. And quarks have properties, and strangeness and charm are two properties of quarks. the other two being color and spin. These things don't mean what we would generally think these things would mean. A friend of mine who is an astrophysicist once told me, when I asked him what strangeness was, he said, if we know about it, it has a strangeness of zero. And if we don't know about it, it has a strangeness of one. I think he was just trying to end the conversation because that was it was clearly going to be like go on and on and on as he got further and further into things I couldn't possibly comprehend. For more on this, tune in to our complimentary podcast, Quantum Mechanics Binge.
Quark Binge.
Quark Binge. Not a bad one. But that's the title of the album. That's where it comes from. And again, as you say, the kind of the cold, stark reality of what we're looking at does bring this new music kind of firmly into view against the cosmic nature of stuff we've seen before.
It does. It also changes slightly my opinion on the Quark, Strangeness and Charm track. I feel like if I know Calvert in any way, and I don't, if he read about Quarks having Strangeness and Charm and then saying like, well, Strangeness and Charm are also human properties, like I kind of said in my thing that like, if you had the same Strangeness and Charm of a Quark, then maybe you would be a more interesting person. That then I guess you can see where the track comes from. So I feel like so this is what I'm saying. It felt like Hawkwind were having a joke that I wasn't in on. I now feel like I get it more. I'm not sure whether or not it saves the piece, but I feel less annoyed with it.
I want to go up to someone and say, sir, you have the strangeness and charm of a quark.
But then they'd be like, a quark we know about or don't know about? Because that changes the way that I react to that statement.
A quark with a strangeness of one.
I immediately redact some of the things I said.
The slightly smaller sacred cow is coming back from the dead. It's interesting, right? Not just the cover, but the fact that they went to hypnosis to get this cover done also suggests Hawkwind, who are trying to shift their image a little bit in line with the music. Mm. It's very deliberate.
It's interesting that it doesn't look like a photo. It looks like a very graphic depiction. I mean, obviously they've got some overlays on it because I'm pretty sure Battersea Power Station doesn't have a orange death beam across the ceiling in the same way that it's depicted here.
Do you know that?
I don't know that, but I would assume. I would think even the power stations of the 70s had some kind of safety protocols, I would have thought. But even like, you know, Hawkwind, the band logo has been kind of reinterpreted in kind of graph paper with a kind of like redshift, blue and orange kind of mix to it. And even Quark, Strangeness and Charm looks like it's just written in Helvetica or something. So it does feel like the more scientific or more kind of like accessibleness has come through this. There's very little fantasy, if anything, beyond the kind of the Doctor Who style laser kind of going through it.
Yeah.
Even the person, like you said, who's asleep on the job in the back with a folder over his face has a very real sense of dystopianness, the idea of the, you know, the scientist asleep at the wheel, which then lets the monkey with the T-virus escape or whatever, you know, that kind of idea of like, if we are going to accidentally destroy ourselves, it's going to be in a really dumb way by like someone who falls asleep or someone who presses the wrong button or something, rather than something way more sinister.
Absolutely. It's almost the casualness of the doom that makes it so chilling. And it is quite a stark, cold cover.
It seems to have the same coloration as that Queen album, which has the robot with them all in like its fist.
Yeah, News of the World, which came out this year.
Huh, interesting. I always thought that was a strange cover, but, you know, like, I feel like the tones are all very similar in this, even with the kind of like the action happening more to like the right side of the album and the band name where it is. I feel like if you did a side by side, there would be like a similar like feeling of structure, if not quite content.
Yeah, no, fair. As a package, as an all-round package, I think it works. I think it's the cover and the music go well together.
Yeah, it feels like Hawkwind, like I said, like growing up in a way, or like, you know, becoming less pure fantasy and more like, or they're finding, you know, ways for their fantastical ideas to be grounded more in reality, which always makes it more chilling. So there's something as well just about, you know, the way that these things are designed, which almost look deliberately off-putting to the average viewer. You know, it's like looking like the inside of a submarine or something, you know, like they're done obviously with a job in mind rather than aesthetics. But the same thing here, like, you know, there's banks of readouts and stuff. I'm sure, you know, makes sense to the people who use it, but it's always looks very isolating and very strange to anyone else who's walking around it. Like if you ever walk through an old factory, and like when I lived in Berlin, there were there's quite a few old places. Like there's an old Cold War listening station at the top of a hill, which you shouldn't go into, but you can break into. which for legal purposes I did not do. But if I had, I would have seen a lot of these kind of things. And there's something very interesting to look at those things and see them almost like you are a modern archaeologist in a way, you know, like looking at all these dials and levers and wondering who ever really understood what they did. All this stuff with its own familiarity will help ignite your imagination. And you could either imagine it as, isn't it amazing what we've made, that we can make this that will power a city and is operated by people who, you know, have way more knowledge of this and specialization than I ever will. Isn't society great? Or you can look at it in a more selfish way by saying, I have no idea what this is, therefore it's dangerous and scary. And it's interesting in like how conservative people can be with that kind of thing. If you feel isolated from it, you feel antagonistic towards it. So it's interesting that that is being used as a device in this album to deliberately make people feel like there's parts of society that you will never understand or comprehend and maybe should be suspicious of.
Yes, is this the Iron Dream, perhaps? So there's less conversation here than there is with six panel foldouts with mystical illustrations of other worlds and logbooks of two-dimensional spaceships and their journeys through space and time. But still, I think a pretty good package and a good illustration that complements the music well. So as we tend to do here, it'll be interesting for us to see this album ranks with Hawkwind Fandom. So now we will take a look at Elric Newby's book, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide, Facebook Top 40 Albums. We've probably done enough albums, even given the albums that we've spoken about so far. The debut album, In Search of Space, Do Re Mi, Hall of the Mountain Grill, and Warrior on the Edge of Time. Where would you put this one for you personally?
For me, this is a really good album. Like, you know, I really enjoyed this one.
Your favorite one to date?
I think, do you know what? Like, it's getting really difficult to call, you know, because there are some things that I really like from previous albums. I think this one is definitely the most consistent.
So we'll get into the breakdown of that in a second. This one ranks number 2 in with Hawkwind Fans. So Warrior on the Edge of Time was number 1. This is number 2. Which I think is kind of amazing. These albums are obviously only 2 years apart, but they're light years apart in terms of the theme and the sounds. And clearly there is an audience here who can have profound love for both of those things, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting that you could change direction so dramatically and come out with an album, which, you know, over a 50-year career and 34 albums or whatever it is, it's number 2 on that chart.
I feel kind of gratified about that in a way, that I thought this was good. I thought it was going to be high. I wasn't sure if it'd be top 5 because, again, I haven't heard so many albums to judge. But in the albums that I have heard, I would have put this pretty high. Hall of the Mountain Grill and stuff I really like. But in terms of the way that this all comes together, I think is much more complete. And I think that's the thing I've said before, like there are things I like and things I'm like, ugh. There isn't really, apart from like, again, maybe that one problematic piece of the first track, there isn't a track on here I massively dislike.
No, absolutely. And with that really starts to take us into our concluding thoughts on Quark's Strangeness and Charm, and time to pick some tracks. So let's do that.
Just with one thing and another, I think I spent less time with this album listening to it than the previous one, just because of, you know, life and just preparation and us trying to, you know, speed up the production of these things. But this didn't need many listens for me to really fall for it. I like the return to the sci-fi-ness that we have in this. The fantastical Hawkwind is fine, but I find it harder to just like really fall into it in the same way that I do with this kind of stuff. I like the fact that they have gone more allegorical. I like it when they give you room to put yourself into the tracks. I like the fact that the things that I liked from the previous album have largely survived intact in order to really like ramp up the musicality of this. So it doesn't feel like protest poetry set to music. It does still feel like songs. the variety is great, as I said at the beginning. I like that the variety is put around a theme rather than like a solid like topic, which means that they feel constrained. This feels like it can venture out into lots of different directions. With the slight mucking around track of the title track, I feel like a lot of the tracks have a depth to them which reward exploration, because I think not always tracks that you think are deep as you feel they are when you actually get into them. I think by the fact that you and I have been talking for over 2 hours about this, when we joked around, you know, when we were listening to this on text between each other, we were like, let's try and do a short podcast for a change. And we thought that, like, but actually that hasn't happened. And again, that's testament to the content of the fact that I've wanted to talk about this. I've wanted to explore it and see what other people have thought. This isn't just something that you put on in the background, which is exactly what I want from a good album, you know? So I've really enjoyed listening to this. This is, again, something that I will listen to after we've done this, which is happening more and more, which is cool. And I think, without getting too like meta about the whole thing, coming to an album like this has made me very happy, given that I don't know Hawkwind. I don't know anything really about them apart from the times that we've played them. I haven't been avoiding them on purpose. I've just kind of had other stuff to do. And when you said, do you want to do this podcast? I was like, sure, because I trusted you and your enjoyment of a band. And I never knew where it was really going to go. But the fact that we've arrived here is massively rewarding for me as a new listener, to really like hear some of the things which I feel are influential and things I still really like, but be able to unpack an album which is, you know, older than I am and get real value from it, reminds me that the output of bands and just music in general is such a rich and explored thing. And like, you know, chasing the now, as we're always kind of taught to do, and, you know, what happened literally yesterday. The fact that we're talking about this when Kanye and Drake have just dropped albums, which people are already arguing over, like, you know, which is the biggest drop. And I'm exploring an album from 1977 and getting just as much content and value as other people are writing about those things. This is, yeah, this is very gratifying to be able to remind yourself that there's so much goodness out there to go and find, in exactly the same way that you suddenly realize that there's an artist you like that has 8 albums to chew through, to you know, to discover bands that have 30 odd albums that you haven't ever gone through, and like dictate some real time in your life to that is great and is massively rewarding. So thanks, dude.
Well, that's fantastic. Like, that is beautifully said. And funny enough, is kind of exactly what I guess I was hoping could happen. You never really know, do you? But I remember, it's interesting, this album for me, because I've never played all the albums like in sequence and explored them like this. And the idea came up because during lockdown, I was playing In Search of Space, which had kind of come back quite heavily into rotation for me over the past year or two for reasons I can't really remember now. And I had an evening where I played the first 5, the first one up to Warrior Under Time, which is the kind of thing you did in lockdown, because, you know, you just kind of did these random things. And that was where the idea came from. But I stopped at Warrior, thought, oh, this would be a good idea for a podcast, see if Matt's into it. So Astounding Sounds was the first one to kind of break out of that little sequence. But this is the first of the albums that historically I remember I really loved that we've come to in that sequence. And re-exploring it has definitely been a joyful experience for me. It's amazing how many albums you can have that you would shout from the rooftops are great albums, but you haven't heard them in 10 years. And this was one, and I heard it, and it was like, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be a good episode, and I can't wait to get this album. And other people have been tweeting, you know, I can't wait to see what Matt thinks of Quark. And I've been really kind of excited about, like, this morning I went out for a long walk, put the album on, give it a last couple of plays before. Now I'm leaving the flat, I'm thinking, this is going to be great. I'm looking forward to listening to this album again. And much like you, my listening to this album will not end with us releasing this podcast. It will always be very close, I think, to the top of that rotation list for me now. I actually think, funny enough, with regard to where this album sits in musical history, I can't help feeling that their profile and their reputation really worked against them. I think there are some bands where it really works for you. Now, like, you take a band like, say, Pink Floyd or Queen, where there's a point in their history where they could literally just break out sneezing in the recording studio and end up with a gold record and some rave reviews. And you get other bands where people are just waiting to hit the snide button on whatever they do. And whatever they come out with is almost tainted by the history that they have. And I wonder if this album in 1977, given what else is released in 77 and the way the world is going and the coming of New Wave, if this had been released by a completely mysterious band that nobody knew, and maybe that band had broken up straight afterwards, this album would be one of the iconic albums like in music history for what it was at the time and what it foretold. And it kind of got a grudging respect. But if it hadn't been Hawkwind, you know, where would it have gone? And that's interesting, particularly in context of what they do next with the Hawklords, which we'll get into on that podcast of that kind of breaking with the past. But I'd said on a previous podcast that I'd always thought there were things that you would love about Hawkwind albums, and I think there were things that you wouldn't love about Hawkwind albums. It's very inconsistent. And that there weren't many Hawkwind albums that I think of as complete albums. Well, this is definitely one of those albums, which is a complete album experience. At 36 or 37 minutes, it's perfect time, because albums that are over 45 minutes have at least one song too many on them. So yeah, I've really enjoyed getting into this, and I'm very happy with whatever you feel about Hawkwind albums, because I know that what you're doing is well thought out, and you put a lot of thought into it, and that it's sincere and authentic. But yeah, there's an element of gratification that comes from someone else who sees what you do basically in an album. So yeah, we've reached a very good place with this. And on that note, it is time to choose the tracks from this that are going to represent Hawkwind and us. First of all, what's going into the master playlist?
Before I say it, I have to say that choosing these were really difficult. I like a lot of these for a lot of different reasons. So I guess what I've tried to do is try to pick the things which are the most novel, or the things which are the most kind of interesting of Hawkwind right now, like irrespective of everything. So the track that I'm going to put into the master playlist is Hosanna Sabah.
A good choice.
It's one of the things where if you pluck that track out of the album, it is complete. We didn't put Magnu into the master playlist, kind of obviously, because it was cool, but there were obviously much more iconic tracks. The fact that we can use this as a point in time to say this is a track where the Eastern influence has really been captured and goes on to influence an entire future generation, really, of musical genres is really good to catalogue. So yeah, that will be the reason why that one goes into our main vault.
Fantastic. A very, very good choice indeed. What will complement it in the sessions playlist?
It's going to be Damnation Alley. It was a big fight between this and Days of the Underground, but Damnation Alley for me will be an interesting kind of counterpoint to Steppenwolf in a way of telling a different kind of story, but using again the kind of the music of the age to subvert the content of the age. And again, just that organ breakdown, I can't let go. It's just so absolutely gorgeous that it needs to be archived somewhere. This was almost going to go over Hosanna Sabah, but I feel just right now that I don't know if something Hosanna Sabah-ish ever appears again. So I'm kind of grabbing it now in a kind of like loss aversion thing, because we've had Damnation Alley-esque things. So I think it's good to have it. But I think, Hosanna Sabah is for me, at least right now, more sonically important. So I want to make sure that that makes it into the master.
Awesome. Two monsters for the sessions playlist. And where can people find these playlists, Matt?
They're going to be on Spotify. We'll link to them in the description of the podcast itself. It will also be linked into the YouTube version of this. We also share it on our social medias. If you basically search Hawk Binge into YouTube, into Spotify, into Twitter or Instagram, you will find us. It's a fairly original title, so we show up pretty quickly. We're archiving these on Spotify. The master playlist is available to listen to now. The two sessions playlists are also available, and we are working on the third, which we won't share until we have a collated amount. But I think when it's ready, that will mark the end of the decade for Hawk Binge. So that will be a good place to finish that and then start number four.
Absolutely. And where can people reach us if they want to give their views either on the podcast or on the Hawkwind albums themselves?
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at HawkBinge on both of those. And we are on YouTube, but you have to currently search just HawkBinge, where we show the more kind of audio visual versions of these podcasts. We can't get a vanity URL until we get 100 subscribers. So if you do like the YouTube version and want to subscribe, that will help us get more easily found, which would be awesome. And if you'd like to write us something more long form, you can email us at podcast@hawkbinge.space.
Fantastic. Well, that has been quite the journey and a great fun podcast to do. We should be changing our name to Binge Lords for the next one, because our next adventure is 25 years on, which refers to the album title, not the amount of time it will take us to record the episode, although we're probably not far short of that. Until then, we bid you goodbye and see you again in 25 years. Now, Andy and I. So...
That says a lot about the podcast.
It really is too early.